is the Music Halls of Fame podcast. This week, we look at the year in music for 2008, along with a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class of 2008. We also make the case for putting Rick Rubin into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Plus, our Spotlight Hall isn't a hall per se. It's the Library of Congress National Recording Registry in Washington, D.C. Before we get going with the podcast, like everyone tells you, please like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell so you'll know when these podcast episodes drop, which is usually every Thursday. Now, on to this week's episode. The year was 2008. In music, Spotify started, first in Sweden before, of course, eventually going worldwide. Will.i.am created a viral song and celebrity music video using the words of then-presidential candidate Barack Obama's speeches, entitling the song Yes We Can. A lot of musicians and other entertainers got behind Obama, helping to propel him to the presidency later in the year over Republican Senator John McCain. Michael Jackson released a 25th anniversary edition of his album Thriller, which turned out to be the last album that was released while he was alive. There would be a bunch of albums released after he passed away in 2009, of course. Scott Weiland left Velvet Revolver. Tina Turner started her 50th anniversary tour. Madonna had the biggest money-making tour for a female solo artist with $280 million made. Taylor Swift and Beyoncé have since broken that record. Quite a bit, actually. A fire on the backlot of Universal Studios Hollywood burned down a warehouse that had held master copies for artists as far back as Louis Armstrong. The original master copies for some artists, like Eminem, were in the process of being transferred to digital copies when the fire occurred. However, a decent amount of the 175,000 master copies supposedly had made it through the process at the time, sending the other melted master copies to the realm of history, never to be recovered. DJ AM and Travis Barker of Blink-182 were involved in a horrific private plane accident that killed four other people, including the pilot, when their private plane skidded off the runway. DJ AM would commit suicide a couple of years later, reportedly due to not being able to deal with the pain from the injuries suffered in the accident. Bands that formed in 2008 included Chickenfoot, Clean Bandit, Fun, The Saturdays, The Swedish House Mafia, and Selena Gomez and The Scene. Groups that broke up, of course, before their inevitable reunions or announced their hiatuses included Hootie and the Blowfish, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, Bauhaus, The Cheetah Girls, King Crimson, Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, Digital Underground, Ministry, Social Distortion, My Chemical Romance, Big and Rich, Incubus, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Westlife, The Police, Toto, Velvet Revolver, and The Spice Girls. Groups that got back together in 2008 included Ben Folds 5, Letters to Cleo, New Kids on the Block, Bad Company, Biohazard, Motley Crue, Portishead, The Counting Crows, Republica, Split Enz, Dishwalla, Dirty Vegas, Eraserheads, Jane's Addiction, The Fat Boys, Triumph, Space Hog, Stone Temple Pilots, Stetsasonic, Yes, Ultravox, and Yazoo, or Yaz, depending on how you're going with that last one. The best-selling album that year was Lil Wayne's The Carter 3. Other artists having big years included Adele, Coldplay, who had the best-selling album worldwide with Viva La Vida or Death and All His Friends, Rick Ross, Alicia Keys, Madonna, Usher, Disturbed, Miley Cyrus, Amy Winehouse, Rihanna, Leona Lewis, Kings of Leon, Josh Groban, Taylor Swift, Janet Jackson, and the soundtracks to Twilight, Mamma Mia, and High School Musical 3. The biggest single was Flo Rida and T-Pain with Low. 2008 was also the year that singer Akon did a cameo on a song to help out another singer who was just starting out, Lady Gaga, on her debut single, Just Dance. 2008 was the year that people first took notice of former religious music artist Katy Perry when her first big single, I Kissed a Girl, became one of the biggest singles of the year. Other big singles were Coldplay's Viva La Vida, Leona Lewis's Bleeding Love, Alicia Keys' No One, Lil Wayne's Lollipop, One Republic's Apologize, Jordan Sparks and Chris Brown's No Air, Sarah Bareilles' Love Song, Usher's Love in This Club, Rihanna's Take a Bow along with Disturbia and Don't Stop the Music, Madonna with Justin Timberlake's 4 Minutes, Jason Mraz, Pink's So What, and T.I.'s Whatever You Like. In country music, one of the biggest scandals of the year was country music singer Mindy McCready confirming earlier reports that she had had an affair with baseball player Roger Clemens that started when she was only 15 years old. Meanwhile, Shania Twain separated and eventually divorced her husband, superstar producer Mutt Lange, after it was found out that Mutt was having an affair with Shania's best friend. Country music superstar Ann Murray gave her last concert and then retired after 40 years of performing. As far as country albums went, Taylor Swift, Tim McGraw, and Toby Keith each had 2 albums that hit number 1 on the country chart, as did albums by Kelly Pickler, Jessica Simpson, Alan Jackson, Julianne Hough, Lady Antebellum, a.k.a. Lady A these days, Darius Rucker, Sugarland, Kenny Chesney, Chris Cagle, Brad Paisley, Jewel, George Strait, and a Now That's What I Call Music compilation album. Big country music singles included Carrie Underwood's All American Girl, Sugarland's All I Want to Do, Montgomery Gentry's Back When I Knew It All, and also their song Roll With Me, Kenny Chesney's Better As a Memory, and also his song Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, the Zac Brown Band's Chicken Fried, Rodney Atkins' Cleaning This Gun, Darius Rucker's Don't Think I Don't Think About It, Alan Jackson's Good Time, and Taylor Swift's Love Story. In hip-hop, L.A. Reid became head of Def Jam Records after Jay-Z stepped down. Twista started his own record label, hip-hop label TVT shut down, and then was brought out of bankruptcy by the Orchard record label. Jay-Z signed his $150 million 360 deal with Live Nation, meaning that Live Nation got a cut from his touring merchandise and record sales. And Nate Dogg suffered 2 strokes. Another stroke would end up killing Nate Dogg in 2011. Fat Joe and 50 Cent continued beefing through the year. Meanwhile, after feuding for 3 years, Big Boy of Outkast and Killer Mike of Run the Jewels stopped their beef, finally. Killer Mike, for those who forgot, started his rap career appearing on Outkast's album Stankonia. Ultra-conservative cancel culture took aim at hip-hop videos, specifically BET for playing hip-hop videos. Ultra-conservatives got companies like Pepsi, General Motors, and Procter & Gamble to pull their ads from the network. So, just in case you thought only liberals were into cancel culture and woke mobs and all that crap, no. Both sides do it on the regular, and it's been going on for decades, kids. Learn that. Anywho, big hip-hop albums that came out in 2008 included Lil Wayne's The Carter 3, Jim Jones's Harlem's American Gangster, Webby's Savage Life 2, Shorty Lowe's Units in the City, T.I. Paper Trail, Kanye's 808's and Heartbreak, Young Jeezy's The Recession, Rocco's Self-Made, Trina's Still the Baddest, The Roots' is Rising Down, Bun B's 2 Trill, Lil Mama's VYP, Flo Rida's Mail on Sunday, The Game's is LAX, Plies's Definition of Real, Ludacris's Theater of the Mind, Rick Ross's Trilla, Nas's Untitled, and Snoop Dogg's Ego Trippin'. Big hip-hop singles included T.I.'s Whatever You Like, T.I. and Rihanna's Live Your Life, Lil Wayne's Lollipop, along with his song Got Money, and A Millie, along with Flo Rida and T-Pain's Low, Flo Rida's In the Air, Snoop Dogg's Sensual Seduction, T-Pain's Can't Believe It, Jay-Z and T.I.'s Swagger Like Us, and Kanye's Love Lockdown. In dance music, the International Music Summit made its debut in Ibiza. Sonny Moore started using the Skrillex name when he started DJing in clubs. Ultra Miami Music Festival hit 10 years old, and on the dance charts, Pop Dance claimed 9 of the top 10 spots as Rihanna, Beyonce, Mariah Carey, Madonna, Neo, Britney Spears, Lady Gaga, and the Pussycat Dolls dominated the charts. Bob Sinclair and Steve Edwards laid claim to the top dance club play spot with their song Together. Other quote-unquote legit EDM artists who had hits were Danny Tenaglia with his song The Space Dance, Mark Picciotti's Turn It Up, Christine W's The Boss, Ultra Nate's Give It All You Got, Eric Prydz's Pajano, Armin Van Buren's In and Out of Love, Afrojack's Drop Down, Morgan Page's The Longest Road, Bingo Player's Get Up, The Prodigy's Invaders Must Die, Chris Lake's remix of Sia's Buttons, Prida's Rack Funk and Miami to Atlanta, Crooker's remix of Kid Cudi's Day and Night, DJ Fresh's Gold Dust, David Guetta's Love Don't Let Me Go, Bitches Amelie, Dead Mouse's Reward Is More Cheese, also Not Exactly, also Alone With You, and also Hi Friend, along with Zoo Brazil's Kids, Chase and Status and Plan B's Pieces, Thin White Duke's remix of Madonna's Miles Away, Funkerman's Speed Up, Ferry Corsten's Are You Ready, Nadia Ali's Rapture, which was originally from her first project, Io, Hardwell's Smoke, Afrojack's Bungee, Justice's DVNO, and the Chemical Brothers' Hey Boy, Hey Girl. The top 10 DJs on DJ Mag's Top 100 DJs list were Armin Van Buren, Tiesto, Paul Van Dyke, Above and Beyond, David Guetta, Ferry Corsten, Sasha, Marcus Schultz, John Digweed, and Infected Mushroom. Rock music was still in its pop-punk phase as artists like The Offspring, The All-American Rejects, and Fall Out Boy had big years. However, there was still room for more mainstream acts like Three Doors Down, Kings of Leon, and Nickelback, along with The Stained, The Killers, Disturbed, and Weezer. Latin music started the year in a bit of a rut. In fact, things were so bad that the Recording Industry Association of America lowered its bar for how many sales it took to have gold and platinum records in Latin genres. Little did they know that the explosion of Latin music that was going to happen about a decade later. Big Latin artists for 2008 included Juanes, Wisin and Yandel, Vicente Fernandez, Marco Antonio Solis, Flex, Enrique Iglesias, Aventura, Camila, Que Paz de la Sierra, and Maná. Musicals or revivals of musicals included Flashdance the Musical, Forbidden Broadway Goes to Rehab, Glory Days, High School Musical 2 on stage, Shrek the Musical, Toy Story the Musical, In the Heights, and South Pacific. Musicals that came out on film or on television included Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus' Best of Both Worlds concert, Cadillac Records' High School Musical 3 Senior Year, Mamma Mia, Camp Rock, and Were the World Mine. Animated musicals included Barbie and the Diamond Castle, Roadside Romeo, and The Little Mermaid, Ariel's Beginning. Dave Matthews' band member Leroy Moore passed away from an ATV accident. Guitarist Richie Edwards of the Manic Street Preachers was declared dead after disappearing in 1995. Other famous artists who passed away in 2008 included Margaret Truman, not the former First Lady, Freddie Hubbard, Eartha Kitt, Odetta, Mitch Mitchell, Edie Adams, Jeff Healey, Richard Wright, Isaac Hayes, producer Jerry Wexler, Ronnie Drew, Johnny Griffin, Joe Stafford, Bo Diddley, Eddie Arnold, Robert Rauschenberg, Layla Genzer, Jessica Jacobs, Klaus Dinger, Norman Smith, Ivan Rebroff, Jaeger Letov, DJ K. Swift, hip-hop producer Johnny J., MC Breed, and Henri Salvador. In award ceremonies for the music of 2008, at the Grammy Awards, Robert Plant and Alison Krauss were the big winners of the night with 5 awards. They won Album of the Year for the album Raising Sand. Record of the Year also went to them for their song Please Read the Letter. Song of the Year went to Coldplay for Viva La Vida, and Adele won Best New Artist. At the American Music Awards, Chris Brown won Artist of the Year. At the Billboard Music Awards, Taylor Swift won Artist of the Year. At the MTV Video Music Awards, Video of the Year went to Britney Spears for Piece of Me. The Soul Train Music Awards weren't held in 2008 because of a Hollywood writer's strike that was going on around the time that the ceremony was supposed to happen. Carrie Underwood, Chris Brown, Katy Perry, Alicia Keys, Kid Rock, and Flo Rida and T-Pain won the music categories at the People's Choice Awards. At the Eurovision Singing Contest that was held in Belgrade, Serbia that year, Dima Bilan from Russia won for the song Believe. Kenny Chesney won Entertainer of the Year at the Country Music Association Awards, and Carrie Underwood won Entertainer of the Year at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Duffy won Best British Album for Rock Fairy, and Girls Aloud won Best Song for The Promise at the Brit Awards. Nickelback won Best Album for Dark Horse, while Cardinal Offshall also won Best Song for Dangerous, and Sam Roberts won Artist of the Year at the Juno Awards. Apocalypto won Album of the Year for The Presets, and Gabriella Silmi won Single of the Year for Sweet About Me at the ARIA Music Awards. At the Tony Awards, In the Heights won Best Musical, and South Pacific won Best Revival of a Musical. The Pulitzer Prize for Music that year was won by David Lang for The Little Match Girl Passion. 2008 was also the year that Bob Dylan received a Special Music Citation Pulitzer Prize. Musically at the Academy Awards, A.R. Rahman won Best Song for Jai Ho from the movie Slumdog Millionaire, and he also won Best Original Score for the same movie, as Slumdog Millionaire racked up a number of awards that night, including Best Picture. Elbow won the Mercury Prize for the album The Seldom Seen Kid. The 2008 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony was held on March 8th at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. At the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony, harmonica player Little Walter was inducted into the Sidemen category. Songwriting and producing team Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff were inducted into the non-performers category. And that year's class of inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame included Leonard Cohen, The Ventures, The Dave Clark Five, John Mellencamp, and this next artist. This artist is one of the biggest selling artists of all time. Her style, music videos, and frank talk about sex and sexuality have both shocked and influenced the past few generations. She's changed personas almost as many times as David Bowie. She is one of the queens of the dance music scene. Her nickname comes from a song on one of the biggest selling albums of all time. She is the woman who told Dick Clark in an interview before that particular album was released that her goal was to, quote, rule the world, end quote. That mission was accomplished with her second album. She is the Material Girl. She is Madonna. Madonna Louise Ciccone was named after her mother and was born on August 16, 1958, in Bay City, Michigan, to Italian Catholic immigrant parents. She was the third out of 6 children at that point. Her mother passed away from breast cancer when Madonna was 5 years old. Her father, Silvio Toni, worked as an engineer for General Dynamics and also for Chrysler. You could say that the seeds of her rebellious ways started at the age of 8 when her father married the family's housekeeper and had 2 more children, bringing the total number in the household to 8 kids. To say that Madonna was unhappy about her dad remarrying would be an understatement, and her relationship with him growing up was pretty rocky at times. And while she seemed to go against the grain with how other girls behaved, the one thing that she always got was great grades. As she said, she wanted to be somebody, and education was the key. To try to curb her rebellious nature, Madonna's dad tried to get her to like playing the piano. However, what she really wanted to do was dance, so she convinced her dad to let her take ballet lessons. She took to ballet immediately and got so good that she went to the University of Michigan on a dance scholarship. And soon, the bright lights of the big city came calling, so she dropped out of college in her sophomore year and moved to New York City with $35 in her pockets. It was in New York where the legend of Madonna would take shape. Madonna first lived in the East Village as the punk rock era was going strong. She continued dancing and grinding away, taking a job at a Dunkin' Donuts for a time in order to make ends meet. During this time, she also went on tour in France for a couple of months as a backup dancer for disco singer Patrick Hernandez. When she came back from France, she and her boyfriend at the time, Dan Gilroy, started the 80s band The Breakfast Club. After she left the group, she formed another band with a new boyfriend called Emmy and the Emmys. Don't feel too bad for The Breakfast Club, though. After Madonna left, Dan Gilroy became the lead singer and the band got a recording deal. Their first album in 1987 yielded them the big hit Right on Track, along with a Best New Artist Grammy nomination. While she was in the group Emmy and the Emmys, Madonna did some modeling, including some nude fine art modeling, along with acting in a small independent film called A Certain Sacrifice. Both the movie and the nude photos were not released until, of course, after she became famous, because everybody decided to make a buck off of her notoriety once she became famous. Go figure. Madonna worked up a 4-song demo while with Emmy and the Emmys and began to work the club circuit in the city, handing her solo demos to any DJ who would actually take one. One DJ who did was Mark Kamens at the club Danceteria that was pretty hot back in the day. The two started dating, and through Mark, she met Sire Records president Seymour Stein, who signed Madonna to a 3-single deal with an option to record an album. Kamens produced her first singles, Everybody, Burning Up, and Physical Attraction. During the promotion of the singles, Madonna and Kamens broke up, and Madonna took up with famed artist Jean-Michel Basquiat for a little while at least. In any event, the 3 songs were pretty successful, so Sire picked up the option for her to record her first album. After she didn't like the work of her first producer, Reggie Lucas, Madonna asked DJ John Jellybean Benitez to remix the album, which he did, and they also, you guessed it, started dating. I'm sensing a trend here. Anyway, her self-titled debut album was a slow burn on the Billboard charts, yielding the hit singles Borderline, Holiday, and Lucky Star. Madonna was determined to make her next album even bigger. She enlisted producer and lead guitarist for the group Chic, Nile Rodgers. Nile had just come off of producing David Bowie's Let's Dance album, which was incredibly successful. Madonna wanted creative control over her new album, but her record label wasn't too keen on the idea, so they spent the money and hired Nile, much to Madonna's delight, as she was a huge fan of his. The album was recorded quickly at the Power Station Studios in New York City. Nile got Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson of the band Chic to play on a lot of the tracks. Nile played guitar as well, so in essence, This album is sort of another Chic album, but with a new lead singer that was female. The album was recorded digitally, which wasn't really popular at that time. Remember, this was the early 1980s. People were still playing video games on the Atari 2600. All right, at least I was. Also, remember at this time that dance music was, by and large, on life support. The musical landscape consisted mainly of new wave, corporate rock and pop, and of course disco was dead, with house and techno music still being considered underground club music. From the start of the album, Madonna had a game plan. She knew that in order to get noticed, you needed to push some buttons. In the 1980s, conservatism was huge. The moral majority ruled the public opinion, and Ronald Reagan was president. Madonna knew that putting her sexuality out there was going to create a lot of controversy, especially once she started mixing it with religion. She did that with songs like a Virgin, along with the iconic album cover of her in a wedding dress with the boy toy thing on her. She chose every song on the album to become hits. She didn't want any weak songs or filler, as she said. The album was finished in September of 1984, but couldn't be released because her debut album was still selling pretty well at that point. The original release had 9 songs on it. In more recent reissues, the albums added the song Into the Groove, a huge hit off of the soundtrack to Madonna's movie Desperately Seeking Susan, which was around the same time period. In fact, it was during the filming of Desperately Seeking Susan that Madonna went from being a sort of known singer having a few hit dance tracks to suddenly becoming a megastar who could no longer walk around the movie set without a trail of paparazzi following her. The album, Like a Virgin, finally debuted on November 12, 1984, but the single, Like a Virgin, had a different debut. On September 14, 1984, Madonna debuted the song at the MTV Video Music Awards, wearing that album cover wedding dress with the boy toy belt buckle and basically just twisting herself all over the stage floor in a sexually charged performance. The audience was stunned, barely said anything, barely even clapped, and of course, controversy followed. Mission accomplished. The album Like a Virgin had 5 top 5 singles on it. Like a Virgin, Material Girl, Angel, Into the Groove, and Dress You Up. The album itself debuted at number 70 on the charts, but hit number 1 less than 2 months later. The album became the first female solo album to sell over 5 million copies. It has sold over 10 million copies to date, and even though it was her second album, it was the album that broke the doors wide open for her and turned her into an icon. Total time spent becoming an overnight sensation? About 6 or 7 years, give or take. It's all about the grind, kids. It's not about the instant gratification. After that, of course, came numerous albums and singles, rumored celebrity relationships with baseball players Jose Canseco and Alex Rodriguez, basketball player Dennis Rodman, and actor Warren Beatty, although that last one was probably faked in order to promote their movie at the time called Dick Tracy. There were her 2 marriages, one to actor Sean Penn from 1985 to 1989, and director Guy Ritchie from 2000 to 2008. There were many, many reinventions, including officially fully delving into EDM on her Ray of Light and also her Confessions on a Dance Floor albums, which both won her a couple of Grammy Awards. Overall, Madonna has put out 14 studio albums, all of which have hit the top 10, with most of those going to number 1, including classics like True Blue, Erotica, and Like a Prayer. Madonna also put out 94 singles so far, with most of those going top 10, including 54 hitting number 1 on either the dance or pop charts. She's also had one of the most successful artist-owned record labels, Maverick, which had huge album releases from artist Alanis Morissette. In fact, she was the one who put out Jagged Little Pill that became a huge hit. And also Candlebox. She is an actress and author of children's books and also a philanthropist. And now she's doing an autobiography and documentary along with another tour, which she just recently made headlines for being 2 hours late to start a concert and having a couple people sue her because of it. More controversy. Madonna, along with Cher, wore all of the wild outfits during a time of ultra-conservatism in Western society in the 1980s. It was Madonna who made wearing lingerie as club or outerwear pretty popular. It was Madonna who helped to make it possible for women to openly celebrate their sexuality and to use it as a strength rather than as a weakness. In short, it was Madonna who took the slings and arrows of the Christian conservative movement of the 1980s. She was and still is a trailblazer, trendsetter, and social influencer before there was such a thing as social media. She pushes all the buttons and plays the media better than most celebrities, although she does burn herself on occasions. Plus, she's in her mid-60s already. Wow, time flies. Presented for induction by Justin Timberlake, Madonna, the Material Girl, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2008, and we have put her greatest hits onto this week's music podcast playlist, the link to which is in the show notes. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you that there is now a Music History in Depth podcast where we go more in depth on a few of the events that happened in music history for that particular week. The Music History in Depth podcast drops every Tuesday on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast from, as does our Music History Today podcast, which goes over the daily events in music history. The Music History Today podcast drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast.
Normally, I look at the case for putting a performer into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but this week I'm going to make the case for putting a non-performer into the hall because, to me, it is a complete travesty that he is not already in. One of the biggest snubs from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voters is to not have Rick Rubin in the hall. For starters, he co-founded the record label that brought hip-hop to the masses, Def Jam, along with Russell Simmons, who's also not nominated, probably for other reasons that we're not really going to get into today. Anyway, Rick is so much more than the guy who helped to make hip-hop great. He's also one of the most influential producers of the last 40 years. He's been nominated for 21 Grammy Awards, winning 8 of them, including Album of the Year twice for the Dixie Chicks and Adele. He's been nominated for Producer of the Year at the Grammys 5 times, winning twice. At this point, I normally would give you an artist's stats to make the case and say, to the tail of the tape we go. Instead, though, I'm going to give you a list of the artists who Rick has either produced or executive produced. So, with that said, to the tail of the producing tape we go. Rick Rubin has produced songs or entire albums for, among many others, LL Cool J, The Beastie Boys, Run-DMC, Slayer, Public Enemy, The Cult, The Less Than Zero soundtrack, Danzig, Andrew Dice Clay, The Black Crows, Ghetto Boys, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Johnny Cash, Sir Mix-a-Lot, Tom Petty, Lords of Acid, Nine Inch Nails, AC/DC, Donovan, System of a Down, Sheryl Crow, Melanie C, Rage Against the Machine, Eagle Eye Cherry, Macy Gray, Aerosmith, Audioslave, Limp Bizkit, Jay-Z, Slipknot, Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, Weezer, Shakira, The Dixie Chicks, Justin Timberlake, U2, Linkin Park, Poison, Vanessa Carlton, Neil Diamond, Jacob Dylan, Metallica, Pete Yorn, Brandi Carlile, Typo Negative, Josh Groban, Kid Rock, ZZ Top, Lana Del Rey, Black Sabbath, Adele, Kanye, Eminem, Lady Gaga, Ed Sheeran, the Wu-Tang Clan, James Blake, Billy Corgan, and the Smashing Pumpkins. I mean, seriously, what more do you need to know? Rick isn't eligible as a performer, but he can still get in one of the other categories with one of the other committees. Phil Spector is in as a producer, so it is possible for Rick to get in. Therefore, Rick Rubin should absolutely 100% be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a non-performer. Each week in this spot, we highlight a different musical Hall of Fame, since there's a bunch more than just the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's, for instance, the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Blues Hall of Fame, the Grammy Museum's Hall of Fame, among many others. This week, though, we're going to talk about a place that isn't a hall per se. However, to me, it's probably the most important. The Library of Congress, aside from being a place in the movie All the President's Men, is the nation's library. Established in April of 1800, it has more than 38 million books, 14 million photographs, 70 million manuscripts, and 5.5 million maps. From a musical standpoint, it's important for a couple of reasons. The first is that it has over 8 million pieces of sheet music and over 3.5 million recordings. The second and more important reason is what it does with certain recordings. Since the passage of the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000, the library has developed a registry to preserve and protect certain pieces of music and other recordings that are considered historically relevant. That's a pretty high honor, knowing that your song or album is so important to the nation that it needs to be preserved forever. This is a pretty high-class list you're joining here. Some of these recordings are actually speeches or radio shows from yesteryear. For instance, the earliest recorded version of Abbott and Costello's Who's On First comedy sketch, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds radio broadcast, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech are all in the registry, as are the first recordings on cylinders that Thomas Edison used to show off the phonograph at an exhibition. The first official class was in 2002. There were 50 recordings that were declared important that year. All of the above-mentioned recordings were in that first class. Only a few of them were from the rock and roll era. A lot of them were jazz. One recording was the first hip-hop song to be put in, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five's classic anthem, The Message. 2007's class was a little bit more mainstream, but not by much. President Harry S. Truman and New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, yes, that's the guy the airport in Queens, New York is named after, both made the registry with various speeches. There were some standards and jazz artists as well. However, there were also singles by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and also Roy Orbison that made it in, along with albums by Joni Mitchell and this next artist. In 1980, Michael Jackson was upset, like really upset. Although his solo album, Off the Wall, had sold over 20 million copies worldwide and had spawned the hits Off the Wall, Rock With You, and Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, the album did not get the Album of the Year award at the Grammys. What's more, he had tried to get on magazine covers, but Rolling Stone magazine famously declined to do a story on him. As he told someone afterwards, quote, "I've been told over and over that black people on the cover of magazines don't sell copies. Just wait. Someday, those magazines are going to be begging me for an interview. Maybe I'll give them one, and maybe I won't. End quote. So with that in mind, Michael went to work on his new album. He recruited Quincy Jones, who had produced Off the Wall, to produce this new album. They recorded 30 songs, agreeing to 9 of them for the album. He got songwriter Rod Temperton to help write the songs Baby Be Mine, The Lady in My Life, and Thriller. Got horror film master Vincent Price to do the voice towards the end of Thriller, which Vincent pulled off in 2 takes. He recruited the members of the group Toto to play on songs like Beat It, had Eddie Van Halen do a guitar solo, and got Paul McCartney to duet on The Girl Is Mine. And when all was said and done, both Michael and Quincy listened to the album and hated it. They then spent the next 2 months stripping down the songs and remixing all of them. Finally, on November 30th, 1982, Michael released the album Thriller on Epic Records, a subsidiary of CBS Records. 7 out of the 9 songs were released as singles. The final song lineup was Wanna Be Startin' Something, which was released on May 3rd, 1983, Baby Be Mine, which was not released as a single, The Girl Is Mine, released October 18th, 1982, and was the first single off the album, Thriller, the final song released off the album, which was November 5th, 1983, Beat It, which was released on Valentine's Day in 1983, Billie Jean, that was released a month earlier on January 2nd, 1983, Human Nature, which was released in July, on July 3rd to be precise, 1983, PYT, Pretty Young Thing, which was released on September 19th, 1983, and The Lady in My Life, which was not released at all. At first, the album did okay. The lead single, The Girl Is Mine, with Paul McCartney, went top 10. The next single, Billie Jean, had a little intrigue, some infighting, plus a little history thrown in for good measure. The song was written by Michael himself. It tells the story of a woman who accuses a man of being the father of her child. According to Michael, the song is not about one woman, but about a bunch of women who accused his brothers, the Jackson Five, of fathering their children back when he and his family went out on tour. According to a few other reports, the song is about one crazed fan in particular who accused Michael of fathering one of her twins. Don't ask me how that's possible. Even that's a stretch. Then, after sending Michael crazed letter after crazed letter, she sent him a letter with a gun, telling him to kill himself at a certain time because if they couldn't be together in life, then they would be together in death, right after she killed their baby. Thankfully, that didn't actually happen. The woman was found and she ended up in a psychiatric hospital. Quincy Jones did not like the song at first and didn't think it belonged on the album. He didn't like the opening of the song at all, but Michael would not change it. Michael also wanted co-producing credit for the song because, according to Michael, the actual song was pretty close to the demo that Michael had made. Quincy said, absolutely not. No way at all. Their arguing actually got to the point where they didn't even talk to each other for a week during the whole thing. Another thing about the song was what they like to call sonic personality, which is when you hear the first few seconds of a song and you instantly know exactly what song it is and who did it. Since the first few seconds of Billie Jean are drums, that meant doing something a bit out of the ordinary. They built a special drum platform and a few other tricks to get that unique drum sound that you hear in the beginning. And you literally only need to hear maybe the first 4 drum notes, and you automatically know it's Billie Jean. There were 2 other things that helped to make this song historic. The first was the music video. Directed by Steve Barron, MTV refused to play the video as they were, quote, a classic rock and roll station, end quote, which was literally just their way of saying that we don't put black people on our channel. Michael's record label president, Walter Yetnikoff, though, famously threatened to go to the media about the issue. According to Yetnikoff, he said, and I quote, "I said to MTV, I'm pulling everything we have off the air, all our product. I'm not going to give you any more videos, and I'm going to go public and effing tell them about the fact that you don't want to play music by a black guy," end quote. And of course, he didn't say effing, he said the full word, but this is a family show. Anyway, when that record label is CBS, the biggest record label in the world at that time, that threat carried an awful lot of weight. MTV relented and played Billie Jean, starting on March 10th, 1983, 5 days after the song had hit number one on the Billboard singles chart. Good choice for them to actually play the video, as Michael helped to turn MTV into a cultural force that changed music for better or for worse forever, and MTV in turn helped to turn Michael into the biggest star on the planet. It was a pretty symbiotic relationship when you actually analyze it all. The popularity of the music video helped the song to stay at number one for 7 weeks and helped to make the song the second biggest selling song of 1983. The second thing that made the song so popular was a particular TV special. The Motown 25 special was recorded on March 25th, 1983 in Pasadena, California. No one knew it at the time, but one performance during that special would end up electrifying the world. The special itself was pretty good. A lot of the Motown greats were there. Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Junior Walker, Mary Wells, and Martha Reeves were all there, and the night had a lot of reunions. Diana Ross performed with the Supremes for the first time in over a decade, actually. Smokey Robinson performed with the Miracles, and Michael and his brothers, the Jackson Five, all got back together. The Jacksons performed a medley of their biggest Motown hits, and then they all left the stage except for Michael. Michael then performed Billie Jean, which was the only non-Motown song to be performed that night. About midway through the song, he spun around, slid backwards, and spun three times. The crowd went wild, for they had just seen Michael Jackson perform the moonwalk for the first time to Billie Jean. Now, the moonwalk was not a new dance, not by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, people had been doing versions of that for years. If you watch old videos of 80s b-boy breakdancers, they did what was known as sidestepping, which was along the same lines. Michael actually learned how to do the moonwalk from two dancers who had done it on the TV show Soul Train. He just took it to a whole other level and did his version of the moonwalk. At the time this special was recorded, the album Thriller had been out for about 5 months and was doing okay on the pop charts. Not too bad. Did hit number one. Billie Jean was finally getting some airplay on MTV, and it did hit number one as well. Also, there was no internet to speak of at the time and no social media, so word hadn't really gotten out about Michael's performance. But that all changed on May 16, 1983, when the Motown special premiered on NBC television. Before that night, Michael was just a popular artist with a bunch of hits with his brothers, the Jackson Fives, and a few solo hits that did pretty well. After that night, though, all anybody could talk about was Michael's performance, and especially the moonwalk. Billie Jean quickly went up the charts again to number one, stayed there for another 4 weeks after that. And that was then followed by the song and music video for Beat It, which also flew up the charts to number one. And that song had a bit of an accident, though, when it was made. A basic working of the song was originally put together with two 24-track recording sync machines. Quincy Jones sent one of the machines to Eddie Van Halen for him to lay down his guitar solo. Eddie did his part, sent the machine back. They then tried to sync the two machines together,
But it didn't work, and in the process, they lost most of the song. All they had were Michael's vocals, Eddie's solo, and a faint drum part that was caught in the background of one of Michael's vocal tracks that wasn't supposed to be there. Time to panic. According to guitarist Steve Lukather of the band Toto, who also did studio sessions during that time period, Quincy called him and Steve's bandmate, drummer Jeff Porcaro, with the news and asked for help. Both of them went over to the studio. Jeff listened to the faint drum part and worked out his own part. Steve worked out the guitar part behind Eddie's brilliant solo. Steve said that he had to convince Michael of one of the chord changes, but they all got it done. And in the end, they synced it together, and this time it worked. Song saved in one night. For the record, though, the guys from Toto also worked on the song Human Nature with Jeff's brother Steve Porcaro, who was also in the band, and John Bettis writing that classic tune. One other fun fact, Toto had just finished their mega-selling album Toto 4 at the time work on Thriller was going on. That, Toto 4, was the album that had Rosanna and Africa on it. Luckily for Toto, they put out their Grammy-winning album earlier than Michael did in 1982, as Thriller's release came out after the Grammy nomination deadline, and Toto 4 was eligible for the awards in 1982, whereas Thriller was eligible for the awards in 1983. Toto 4, by the way, won the Grammy for Album of the Year for 1982. So there you go. Lucky them. The combination of the music videos, Billie Jean and Beat It, suddenly made MTV must-see television and turned the network into a pop culture phenomenon. As for Michael, well, it's really hard to describe just how huge he became. I'll try it this way. Take the craziness over Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, BTS, NSYNC, and virtually every other teen sensation, then combine them, and you might get close to the craziness that surrounded Michael Jackson. If you don't believe me, then go check out some of the footage from that era on YouTube, especially some of his live videos. The man literally had thousands of people waiting outside every hotel that he stayed at throughout the world just so he would make an appearance and wave to them. They had to close off streets just so this guy could go from place to place. He was essentially the 80s version of Beatlemania, with all those crazy girls running after John Paul, George, and Ringo. It was a lot like that. As for Thriller, it started selling over a million copies a week and then went to number one on February 26, 1983 and stayed there for 37 weeks, only to be interrupted during that time a few times by other albums like Prince's Purple Rain soundtrack before going right back up to number one again. Michael received a lot of critical acclaim and 8 Grammy Awards, along with 8 American Music Awards, including that elusive Album of the Year Grammy Award. It's been certified to have sold over 34 million copies in America, making it the 2nd biggest selling album of all time in America behind the Eagles' Greatest Hits, but has claimed sales of 67 million copies worldwide, making it the biggest selling album of all time on the planet. It still to this day sells almost 100,000 copies a week worldwide. Oh yeah, about those magazines that wouldn't put him on the cover. Rolling Stone magazine did come begging for him to do an interview with them, even though they had only given him 4 out of 5 stars in their initial review for Thriller. Go figure. Michael thought about it and then granted them the interview, but only if they put him on the cover. They obliged, with that issue with him on the cover becoming their biggest selling issue in a very long time. Of course, there's also the Thriller short film / music video, but that has its own segment for a whole other day, because boy, can you talk about that one. After Thriller came other successful albums like Bad and Dangerous and an awful lot of rumors and controversy, culminating with his early death in 2009 and an HBO documentary that trashed what was left of his reputation. But that's a story for another time. For now, just appreciate the man, his talent, and this amazing album that you still can't put down, especially every Halloween. Michael Jackson's 1982 classic album Thriller, inducted into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry, class of 2007, and of course, you know we put that album onto this podcast's music playlist for the week. The link is in the show notes.
The Music Halls of Fame podcast is part of the Music History Today Network, which can be found under Music History Today on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts from, and also on our YouTube page under Music History Today. Thank you very much for listening.